So here we've got an extension of what we were looking at last week. And my apologies if you haven't heard the sermon last week. It is available on the website if you want to go back to it. But we were looking in John 13, and we're going to read through the key text, which was from John 13, 34. Can we read this together? I'm giving you a new commandment, and it's this: love one another just as I have loved you, so you must love one another. This is how everybody will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for each other. And we talked about the three dimensions of the church that is birthed in Acts 2, on which this church is just a part. The church that radically loves God, that is dedicated to one another, and is dedicated to that cause, has a compassion for those who are lost, and is wanting to take the gospel to them. And of course, that the one who knows us best loves us most. There's one or two of you have come up to me and said, "Oh, that's a great line this week." Just to say, it's not my line, but can I remember who it was? My best guess, it was a friend of mine called Julie Tennant, who's she's a minister's wife from, well, she's staying at Kentucky these days. But that's my best guess. It may not have been. You know that thing where you just remember. But it's such an important phrase. The one who knows us best loves us most. In other words, the one who can see how we are, how we're put together, all of the ups and downs of that, that person loves us the most. That's the message of the scriptures. It's an astonishing thing. So what I want to do just now is to move on. Now I want you to keep the 23rd Psalm in your thoughts, especially that phrase, "You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies." We'll be coming back to that. I also want you to keep in mind something that those of you who went to Sunday school perhaps had to memorize from Galatians 5:22, that the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, and self-control. Okay? I can't do them in any other order, but I can do them that way. Those eight characteristics. So keep that in mind. And we're going to read from John 14. You can follow it in the scriptures on your pew, under your pew. But I'm going to be reading it from Tom Wright's own translation. So that's John 14, reading from verse 12. "I'm telling you the solemn truth," Jesus continued. "Anyone who trusts in me will also do the works that I'm doing. In fact, they will do greater works than these, because I'm going to the Father. And whatever you ask in my name, I will do it, so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. And if you ask anything in my name, I will do it. If you love me," he went on, "you will keep my commands. And I will ask the Father, and he will give you another helper to be with you forever. This other helper is the Spirit of truth. The world can't receive him because it doesn't see him or know him. But you know him because he lives with you and will be in you. I'm not going to leave you bereft. I'm coming to you. Not long from now, the world won't see me anymore. But you will see me. Because I live, you will live too. And on that day you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. Anyone who has my commandments and keeps them, that's the person who loves me. Anyone who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love them and show myself to them." So, part of the reason of going back over John 13 is Jesus' commandment to them is this: love one another. I was listening to some of you may never have heard of John Wimber. Some of you will have heard of John Wimber. No one's had a more profound effect on the church in the late 20th century than John Wimber. He was a producer for the Righteous Brothers, played keyboards with them. You know, then he lost that loving feeling and went off to become a preacher. And I mean, came from a completely unchurched background. It was great. He said when someone first said to him, "Have you been washed in the blood of the Lamb?" He said, "I'd seen horror movies. I was wondering when they did this." You know, it could be very distressing. John Wimber was talking in Edinburgh, and he was introducing us all to working in the power of the Spirit. And he said at the end of one talk, he said, you know what? How about we just love one another? Go off and do that for 50 years. When we've got that link, we'll come back and do this stuff. When Tom Wright was commenting on that church in Acts 2, and someone had said to him, it says signs and wonders were happening there. They don't happen very often in our day. How come? And he says, well, perhaps we haven't got the first bit down yet. We're not loving one another. That's Jesus' command. Love one another. And that love isn't just the hard work of trying to like each other. Indeed, you can love someone profoundly and not like them very much at all. Any parents? Isn't that true? Someone needs to write that book, What to Do When You Hate Your Kid. Really, it comes our way. How can you love someone that you profoundly dislike? Some of you are going, hang on a minute, how does that work? Well, here's how it works. Even when they do stuff that makes you irate, when there's been shouting or disagreement, we can still lay down our life for them. We can still do the right thing for them. We can still be there for them. Even though. Because thank you, persons who shook their head, because here's one of the most important things about love I'm ever going to tell you. And this was inspired by another musician, Don Francisco, who came here years ago. He wrote a fantastic song which said, Jesus did not die for you because it was fun. He hung there for love because it had to be done. And in spite of the anguish, his word was fulfilled, because love is not a feeling, it's an act of your will. What do you do when you don't love someone anymore? You know, I mean, we have all this catalog of music and stuff which talks about the feelings, and the feelings are great. They really are, especially when they're in the right place. But sometimes the feelings are in the wrong place. We don't have feelings for the person that sometimes in a marriage it happens that someone catches your attention, and feelings start to build for them, not for the person that you promised to marry. And at that point, decisions of will are really, really important. I have one particularly brave minister who runs a pre-marriage course. He says, what are you going to do when you fall in love with someone else? Love is about decisions of will. Am I going to turn up? Am I going to go meet that person? Am I going to dig deep in my pocket to help that situation? Am I going to commit myself to this cause, even though it's a struggle? Am I going to overcome my desire to sit down with a big bag of Doritos and a DVD and phone my mom? Ah, you see, you know it, don't you? Love's about acts of will. And yes, there can be relational breakdown, and yes, sometimes it's hard work. And Lord knows, I know that from my own family. I know many of you know it from your own personal experience. But there is something honorable about those moment-by-moment decisions. Now, I've been thinking a lot recently about our own Brenda and about Lena, both who had husbands who died recently. Lena cleans in the halls, and both of them were very ill. And that decision to get on the bus and to go visit in hospital, regardless of whether you feel like it or not, is an act of will, and that is profound. Profound love. And actually those countless little decisions that we make regarding what we do, that constitutes us loving one another. Love is primarily an act of will. And indeed, I'm not going to advocate arranged marriages, though I'm of the age where my peers and I have daughters of a certain age, and arranged marriage seems like a really good idea when your daughter gets this one. Oh, yes, it does. But arranged marriages and romance marriages have about the same success and failure. us. That isn't here, and I've got a gazillion things to say, and it's communion. However, we're just going to share some thoughts about this. So John, in John 14, is talking about another helper. He's talking about giving of himself. There's this extraordinary thing that when we're making those decisions of will, which actually often the feelings trolley along behind, you know, if you act like you love someone, you will eventually end up liking them most of the time. Just put that in its context. But in terms of what Jesus is talking about here, the things we do automatically are always our worst enemy. And I don't know about you, but I tend to fall back on my own resources till I run out. You know, this is all down to me until I'm sad or grumpy or whatever it might be. But that's not what Jesus is advocating. So, a perfectly well-intentioned person, you might be sitting there saying, if I've got to love other people as God loves us, I've got to try really hard. Try really hard, try really hard, try really hard, try really hard. And then, of course, you end up in a muddle. Because we run out of resources. You have a certain amount of time, perhaps a certain amount of affection, and eventually you do need to sit down with a big bag of Doritos and a DVD. You do. Because recreation matters. We all need a Sabbath. So, Jesus is describing here, he's trying to give them an idea of what loving one another like he's loved us means. Where did Jesus get his resources? From his Father. You can read it in Mark 3, you can read it all over the New Testament, is that Jesus would retreat away, sometimes into the wilderness, sometimes in the dead of night because people can't find you because there's no streetlights, and so you can hide really easily. I think it was easier for introverts in those days. You know, you've all seen Blazing Saddles, just a few steps away from the fire, you're in pitch blackness. Don't think about Blazing Saddles. You did. And I know what you're thinking about. But the darkness that was around in the ancient world gave people that room to retreat. And people were... Jesus did that. And his relationship with God was so profound that he could call him Dad. And not only that, but he understood that his mission was to reconfigure the relationship between human beings and people so that we too could call him Dad. When you pray, pray like this, said Jesus in Luke 11. Our Father. Our Father. And the word he uses there is Abba, which is an Aramaic word which is somewhere between daddy and father. You know, it's just what kids would call their dad. And of course, Abba, like Dada, which is the one word that Gabriel's got at the moment, is, you know, oftentimes that's the first word that a child will develop. That's the kind of relationship that Jesus wants us to have with God. How much trust does a newborn have in their parents? Well, they don't really have an option, do they? If they sense a breach in relationship, though, they do. Wow! 7 o'clock this morning. It was a happy wow, but it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make it any easier to sleep. Because Gabriel's busy saying, hey, guys, I'm awake now. Feed me, entertain me, teach me something. I've had my sleep. What's up with you guys? Leave me alone. And that's the relationship that this is why it's important that it says in the Psalms, in Psalm 121, that God doesn't sleep. Because when we are ready to make contact with him, he's already making contact with us. And Jesus is describing this thing. He's saying that if you love me, you'll obey my commands. And if you obey my commands, that's how you love me. But of course, the command is, you know, don't park on double yellow lines or, you know, don't swear at your auntie. All it is love one another as I've loved you, which might involve not parking on double yellow lines and swearing at your auntie. It's just that we tend to turn it into rules. And actually what Jesus is saying is this got to be in the context of a relationship in which you receive the love in order to give. And you see a great dynamic tumble dryer of a thing going on here. That I'm in my Father, and I'm in you, and you're in me, and I to bear. And it's the Holy Spirit that does this. Jesus says, I'm not going to leave you bereft. I'm going to give you another helper. In other words, not me, but the Holy Spirit. So he describes him here as the Spirit of truth. And truth, I suppose that Greek word truth means, it doesn't just mean not telling lies, but it's got that kind of weight of meaning. It's by the way, that's where the name Althea comes from. It's from the Greek word for truth. But it's that truth that is right down. This is something that is trustworthy. This is a thing that is. The love of a parent for a child. The love of a son for a father. The love of us in Him for one another. You see, when we love one another, we glorify God. We say yes to Jesus. We make the cross make sense. When we love one another, it all starts working. And as we go to God, and I was praying this morning, I said, Lord, just want to humble myself before you. Work through me for your glory. And I pray that prayer. It's a kind of, it's kind of like, it's like when you know a horse is going to win. Not that I bet. But, you know, some of you shouldn't. But hey, okay. But it's a dead cert. There's no doubt about it. That if we humble ourselves before Him and just say, Lord, work through me. I know that I can't do this. I couldn't lead a church for Toffee. But you at work in me, at work in them, at work, maybe we can see something going. That's what Jesus is describing here. And He is describing it around a table. Was that you, Richard? You're the smartest guy in the church. Now, okay, so that's how this is all working around the table, okay? By the way, they didn't all sit on one side. Those of you who've seen the picture of the Last Supper, Leonardo was a good painter, but we won't write about that. Now, in fact, they were probably on a low table and reclining. That's why we read in John's Gospel that the disciple who Jesus loved was resting his head on Jesus' chest. Because they're all kind of like lined up around the table like that, a low table. Okay. Which bit have I done? That bit. Oh yeah. Any other tables you can think about in the gospel stories, in the wider story? Hannah was taking us to the road to Emmaus in Luke 24, and Jesus is kind of sneaking along beside them saying, oh, who's Jesus? What's all this about? And they're saying, you don't know? Haven't you got a clue? And then they get back, they sit around the table, Jesus breaks the bread, they go, ah! And Jesus disappears. Any other tables? Yes, Richard. Ooh, which is taking a bit of Psalm 23 and Song of Songs is actually where His banner over me is love comes from, which was a whole new spin on a lot of my Sunday school experience. But we'll leave that to one side at the moment, but you're right. He prepares a banqueting table for me. But think about back in that original story in the Exodus. I know we tend to go to Genesis and then have fist fights with atheist scientists, but really, for the Jewish people, they go back to the Exodus. Genesis is like the prequel to Exodus. And there they have this meal at the Exodus, because now Moses has finally persuaded the Pharaoh to let my people go. They're going to come out of slavery. And he's done that thing, remember we were talking last week about that, and how he managed to do it in his 80th year with a stick and a stuff there. It's a great line, I can't resist it, sorry. And he's about to lead them out, but the last plague is still to happen. And this one mirrors the genocide of Jewish boys. And the firstborn of everything is going to die. The angel of death is passing over. But guess who that is? The angel of death is passing over. And the only way that you can get the angel of death to pass over your house and not kill your firstborn is to paint the blood of a lamb on the doorposts of your house. You'll be safe inside. And this is true for Egyptians too. Remember that story? Some of you are there. That's freaky. This happened about 1500 BC. The foundational story of the Jewish people is the Exodus. God had to allow them to go. go into slavery and then free them from slavery for them to understand who they were. And so around this table in John 14, he's around the Passover table. Now, John takes it for granted that we've got the story that's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He doesn't describe the Last Supper, but they're gathered around the table at the Passover. The other guys have done a good job of telling the story. He wants to tell the story of some of the discussion that went on around that table. And it stretches right through from John 13, right through to John 16. You've got three chapters of stuff that happened at the table, and we're going to work through it. And so in John 14, Jesus is saying, I'm going to give you another helper. It's not going to be just down to you. You're not going to have to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. You're going to be given the power, the love, the compassion. You're going to be given the vision. You're going to be given so much that you're going to go and try and do the things I've done. You're going to do greater things than me. Okay, how many water walkers we got this week? Won't be great in that. Walking on air? But we sort of look at it.
Oh, yeah, right.
I can see a bad promise where we go. How could we do great work? Same way Jesus did. By trusting in the Father. And there's all sorts of stuff in the New Testament about why we don't see it. But I can point you to places where they are seeing it. Where there's gatherings of people much greater than Jesus ever spoke to, where people are following Jesus in greater numbers than Jesus ever inspired, and where astonishing things are taking place, just as they lift the name of Jesus and they put things in the right order. And they're starting to happen here. So, now my time. Right. I think we're going to move on to this bit. So you prepare a table in the presence of our enemy's father. What is it? What's that all supposed to mean? And here's my best stab at what that means. Is what I told the kids. That God's kindness to us reaches out. Even in tough times. Even in tough times. Now, first of all, I want to take you back to something that happened this summer. And I do want to say a big thank you to... Hey, here we go. Right, this summer... Sorry for the semi-naked gentleman, but it was very, very hot, okay? What you're looking at is 40 tons of hardcore on top of the scraped driveway. And just big thanks to John McLean, to Callum Rowley, to Liam Tomerole, and he took the photographs. And to everybody else, and for Janice and Yvette for being our... You know, they've just kept the guys across at the hub in a good place, should we say. We've been good neighbors. So we decided we wanted to lay this area. The cheapest of the quotes we had was, well, when you have a back end north of 20,000. We reckoned that we might be able to do this area for about half of that and pull some strings. And with the cooperation of Kernahan and LaFarge Tarmac, we were actually able to do this whole area all in for about $9,000. Okay? Now, when you think that those monoblockers who knock on your door will charge you $6,000 to do it that way, that's not bad. Not bad at all. Indeed, the quantity surveyor guy said, look guys, you're really getting the tarmac for cost. However, what had happened is the guys had come around on this particular day and we'd done our best to get this thing flat, okay? But we're good at some stuff, but we're not that good at laying roads. John McLean used to. He says, Mark, my eye's not what it used to be. So we've got the one road ganger, and it's not going as we were hoping. And so we're looking at this thing going, and the guys from LaFarge Tarmac come in and say, the tarmac's coming tomorrow. It was great. Willie the foreman, as only foreman on a building site can do with his hard hat. He's about 5'2". Hard hat, you know, wee wiry guy, tie. Shirt and tie and a high visibility vest. He's better dressed than me, and he's on a building site. Now, Willie had come across and said, that's no good. That's no good. We can't lay tarmac on that. It's no flat enough. And there's a run. There's a run that's going to run towards your building. To which I thought, nuts. Because we tried to make sure it didn't. And you're short of hardcore there. So, Kernahan said very kindly that they give us a bit more hardcore for involved a bunch of guys. It was like a sort of United Nations thing, because there were people there from Latvia, there were people there from Poland, and there were Scots guys there too. And they stood around there in their boiler suit thingies, and with their rakes, their black rakes, you know, and their hard hats. And they've said, no, we can't lay tarmac on them. So I walked away and started praying. And I said, Lord, you're going to have to get us out of this. I can't imagine that we're going to be able to do, because we'd actually been working our butts off. We'd been up late at night, the gala day was coming to up, there was in the garden court, and Diane was doing it, saying, you've got all the stuff for the gala day, and I was kind of running a church and being a dad to a small nation, so we were kind of under a bit of pressure, and we were pulling out of stock, weren't we, Calvin? We really were. We tried as hard as we could, and we got as far as we could, and they're saying, no, we'll go do that. So I went away and prayed for about 2 minutes, and I came back. You must have been praying, says Willie. He says, how's that? We're going to help you. And out they came. There's about a dozen of them with their rakes, and they just start working away, flattening this thing out and tamping it down. And then a guy gets in a digger that could probably bake a cake with a digger. He was great, just stuck the fag in the side of his mouth, and he was just like this. Oh, yeah, that's fine. And when that digger, when they do, we borrowed the one from next door. It was just an incredible, just a wee time, okay? So we had to say thank you. Yes, we did. So we did what we do well. And I have to say, Liam took a day off work, and Janice and Callum got his barbecue, and Janice was on the grill. There we go. Callum got some banging tunes at the subs on the, because he nicked some of the PA and stuck it out the disabled entrance. We were entertaining half a Gore Bridge with radio rubbish, and we wound and dined them. We wind and dine them. As I said to them, we are rubbish at laying roads, but we can do hospitality. And there was a big ice bucket of drinks, and they were just pulling tinnies out because folks had given some tinnies to the food bank. And, you know, some of the stuff we couldn't distribute, we just put that on offer. It was just brilliant. It was absolutely fantastic. And that all happened spontaneously. And here, I think that's my favorite picture, because here's a bunch of guys. I think that's Liam's cousin there. He came to help too. Colin was his name. And here's a bunch of guys sitting in the shadow of the cross eating burgers. Because it must have been about 27 degrees that day. It was absolutely, it was boiling. And the tarmac went down and it got done, which is brilliant. And I was thinking about that. You prepare a table for us in the face of our enemies. What was the enemy here? Can he do it? You haven't got the cash. Poverty, lack, all that stuff. Those are enemies. They threaten God's work every turn. And we need to learn to deal with them appropriately. With faith and with prayer. Now, I have to tell you, we still haven't quite filled. We did manage to pay the bill, but we managed to pay it with some money that was set aside for other budgetary things. So we've still got a bit of a deficit on the back of it. But nobody thinks the tarmac was a bad idea, right? Especially the Zumba ladies, who the following Tuesday, the first group I saw, I was driving past them, really crashed my van, because over the top of the mound of earth, all I could see was lycra-clad ladies giving it this. And it was all moving in all sorts of directions. And I thought, that's the unforeseen consequences of God's grace, is it not? It was so brilliant. Don't tell him, okay? But I went to get Diane, and we were heading off that way, but I detoured that way to the inlet. Have a look! It was exhausting watching them. I'm telling you, they'll have a before and after picture. Zumba, that's what to do. Which makes a difference in the usual thing with Zumba, which is where we're doing the Kirk session, and here in the door's going. Now, there it is. Yippee. Kind of looks like it's supposed to, doesn't it? And has negated the need for four-wheel drive vehicles to get people around. And it means our Redwoods friends can drive in. And it's just, on all sorts of levels, great. Also means we can run this. The Gorbridge Parish Church Harvest Sunday funding for one day. Praying for a sunny day, but we've also got things set up so that it's not a sunny day. We might even, we're contemplating what we put in here, but you can get two very big inflatables in here if you just move the pews out. So, that's planning at the moment. God's provision for us. Now, you prepare a table for us in the presence of our enemies. God bless you. And what does that mean? Well, sometimes that means we get help from unexpected places. Who thinks about sitting down for a picnic when you're face to face with your enemy? Doesn't make sense. You prepare a table for us in the presence of our enemies. And at communion, we think back to that Passover where God's given instruction to the Jewish people that they are to sit inside and they're to do their stuff in a particular way. They're to take a one-year-old perfect lamb, a lamb in its prime, not some diseased thing that's going to die. And the slaves, that was a big sacrifice to make. They're to kill it and prepare it with bitter herbs. They're to have flat bread cooked, their bags packed, their cloaks on, tucked into their belts. These guys are ready to walk. And outside, with some of those herbs, they're to paint the blood from the lamb on the doorposts, on the lintel and on the doorpost of their door, which would almost certainly be made of wood. You just imagine that, and here's Jesus in the upper room sitting around saying, love one another as I've loved you. You're going to do greater things. I'm going to be in you, you in me, I'm my Father. It's all going to work like that. The life of the Godhead is going to inspire you. You're going to be able to love. You're going to be able to do this stuff. And then just like at the communion, as he takes it, he's the lamb, he's got the bread and wine, and he's going to stick the blood on the doorposts the next day so that the people inside can be blessed and freed and taken care of. As the children of Israel stood up, they had their bags packed with flatbread. They had the leftover lamb. They had the riches that were given to them by the Egyptians to basically underpin the start of their nation. And they carry that off into the desert set free. And as Jesus says to us, I prepare a table for you in the presence of my enemies. He knows that we will not have to face that enemy without him first facing it, as his blood is painted on the posts of the cross. And he stands at the door and makes sure that the enemy cannot get in. And he's the one who deals with the badness and the sadness and the addiction and the fear and the horror and the heartbreak and the abuse. He's the one who takes all of those things. He faces them down at Calvary so that when we face them in our lives, we do not do so alone. That is what he was doing. So this communion season, what enemies are you facing? What enemies are you facing? It may be people, but the scriptures remind us in the 6th chapter of Ephesians that really we do not wrestle with other people. We don't wrestle with flesh and blood. We wrestle against powers and principalities. There's dark stuff at work in our world. We resist that. Where is God calling you to trust him like a child with his Father? What is it that God wants to do in you as you release your burdens and your fears, your anxieties, your sadness, your pain to him? What does he want to give you in return? Because he prepares the table in the presence of our enemies. And here's the thing. As we grow to be like Jesus, we take on his ability to face the darkness and still know the goodness of God. In the garden later in John 17, Jesus will be talking to his Father. He hasn't lost his trust in his Father, and yet he's shouldering the wickedness of the world. The fear and the horror and the pain is on his shoulders, and he takes that for us. As we mature as Christians, as we learn to participate in the love life of the Godhead, we don't become immune to pain. We don't lose our ability to suffer. But what we do gain is an ability to appreciate the joy and the peace, that extraordinary presence of God in our lives, even when our own life is falling to pieces. And so yesterday, when I was sat with my father, who has been bombed back into early childhood by multiple strokes and heart attacks, he's so disabled now, and I've prayed for him to be healed, and I've trusted in the Lord to do so, and still there